accession number 20515, reel 4.
But that was a different unit that you were talking about, where you had the Canadian CO, because that was British other ranks,
yes,
as opposed to Madrasi other
That's
ranks.
That's right, yes. And of course, I was still with this unit when the war finished in again in Europe, but before the atomic bomb was dropped. And it was then, of course, that there was an election in England. And we were all entitled to vote, and we did that, but of course several days before they were counted and the result announced in England. And I'd been censoring the men's letters, and I was pretty clear from those which way that the voting would go. Although I know that one chap did say to me, he thought Churchill was a good chap, and he would like to vote for Churchill, and he wanted to vote Labour. I pointed out that it was only the people in Churchill's constituency who could actually vote for Churchill, and I'm pretty sure that he would come back. But he could still vote Labour for a Labour government if he wanted to. One of our officers, Charlie Day, I remember he always used to read the Manchester Guardian. He was a very strong liberal and was always pushing the liberal cause. And on the day when we were actually voting, he went into the tent and put it in, and then he came out and he whispered to me, "I voted Labour." And of course the election was won. Now,
were there discussions in the army at that time about politics, or was it a subject which was avoided?
Oh yes, well there were discussions, yes, and we used to use what they called ABCA sessions. That's the Army Bureau of Current Affairs. And they were very good. They would send out information leaflets which could be used as a basis for discussion. And yes, that was they were very useful, and that was very good.
Did you have political discussions in your unit?
Yes. But not for very long, because it didn't last very long, because shortly after the election, and in fact, I was only in the unit for just only about a month, and then the whole of the unit was repatriated. But of course, we who had only just come out to India stayed behind, and then I went to another Madrasi unit, not the same one that I was in before, not the same troops, but I was very impressed, not just with the skill of the troops there, which was very good, but the fact that being Madrasi, there was a great variety, first of all, of languages. Most of them spelt either Tamil, Telugu, or Malayalam, but even within those languages, I think there were different dialects in all the villages. So English was the language that was used in giving orders to the troops. And I think all the NCOs could speak and understand English, and most of them could read and write it. And a good many of the other troops could as well. But also, we had different religions. Most of them were Hindu, but there were quite a large number of Muslim and quite a number of Christians there. And I remember Abdul Ghaffur Khan was a naik, that's equivalent of corporal, and he was a Muslim. And he got on, and there was no problem at all with these different religions. They all work together very well indeed. The only difference we found was with the rations, which came usually as live rations, and each religion had its own cook and I don't know what you call them, slaughterer anyway, and prepare their own food. But as far as other work is concerned, they all got on very well together, no problems at all. Yeah.
What was the attitude of the troops towards the British officers?
Well, I don't know that there's any different from the of the British troops. We got on quite well. We talked about things. I think the biggest difference here was when it came to welfare, if you like, particularly when the war had finished, and we had a lot of work to do with the troops. We transferred from Bihar, where it was. We were out of we're in north India, Bihar. We moved from there down to Coimbatore, in the south of India, in the Madras province, because the troops were then going to be disbanded, I suppose, and sent back to their homes. And we had quite a lot of things to do with preparing them for this. And one of the things that we did was based on the village uplift movement, which, as far as I know, was done by organized by Brigadier Brain. And he'd certainly written several things about what they did there. And one of the things that we were teaching the men to do was hay box cooking. Now, the Indians use a lot of ghee, as clarified butter, in their food. And to make this, you need to bring the milk up to boiling point and keep it there for quite a long time. And because wood is fairly scarce there, the fuel for this they use is the cow dung, which is dried and used as fuel. Now, the village uplift movement showed how hay box could be used to make ghee by bringing the milk to boiling point, putting it in this tin or metal box container, and packing it with straw in a hole in the ground. And that kept the milk at that temperature for a long time. And it made very good ghee. And then the dung, which had been used as previously used as fuel, could now be used as fertilizer in the fields. And we actually did this and showed the men that could be done. And I remember saying to one of them, "Now, what do you think of this? Very good, son. Very good. Very good ghee. Will you use it when you get back home?" "Oh, no, sir, no. My father not doing it that way. My not doing it that way." I don't know if it did have any effect eventually, but that was one of the attitudes we had. There's a lot of welfare work too with the troops. A lot more here, I think, than there was in England. One of them, I remember, was Naik Bhaskaran, and I had a letter. This one was typed by, all done by the village letter writer. This one was typed in blue ink on brown paper, and it said that it was from Naik Bhaskaran's father, whose wife had died, and he had three, four young children to look after. And he said it was essential that something should be done, and they had found a suitable wife for Naik Bhaskaran, and could he please be given leave to come and marry her. Well, I spoke to Naik Bhaskaran and checked with him, and yes, he was quite happy with this arrangement. He didn't know the girl, but if his father said it was all right, it would be all right with him. So, okay, I agreed, and he was given leave and to go and get married. Gunadongaya was slightly different. I only came in the middle of this because there'd already been a lot of correspondence about it. His mother was being harassed by somebody else in the village, and they had stopped the water coming to her house, and he gave a list of names and how the police were, had been bribed and so on. I had a lot of correspondence, letter after letter on this. In fact, perhaps I'm a coward, but I passed it over to Jemadar Selvaraj, who was one of our Maestro's commission officers, and to him to deal with, which I trust he did. The Viceroy's commission officers were Indians who did not have the King's commission, as we did, but it was the Viceroy's commission. And in theory, they were exactly equivalent. So a Jemadar was the equivalent of, I think, a lieutenant, a Subedar. Jemadar, I think, was the captain. Subedar was the lieutenant. So they were actually equal in rank to captains and lieutenants, but was regarded as not quite equal. Well, as I said, we did a lot of work with the Indians there. But the one thing that I was a bit worried about was what was called aid to the civil power. You see, there was, had happened for a long time, of course, a big movement for independence in India. And now that the war was over, there had been riots in Bombay. And there was always a fear that something would happen. And British troops might be called upon by a magistrate to help keep order if there are any riots starting. And we were given drills to carry out, and in fact I was given the job by my battery of organising these for the British officers and NCOs, and in fact any Indian other ranks who might be called upon to act. And we had to go there. I mean, if there are any rioters there, we were supposed to face up to them, and we might eventually have to order them to fire. But again, we can only do this on the instructions or with the permission of a magistrate. Although, of course, there was always the bit at the end we said, if no magistrate is available, then you must use your own initiative. And I must say, I was horribly afraid that I might sometime be faced with the job of having to shoot an Indian. I'm glad to say that it didn't ever happen. I, of course, was, I could understand the Indians wanting independence, and I was all in favour of that too. But there seemed to be a lot of problems between the Indian Congress, which was Hindu, and the Muslim League. And yet I'd found to say that the Muslims and the Hindus had got up perfectly well in this unit, worked up well together, no problems. So I don't know. I don't know really what the answer would be. Well, they did find an answer, of course, by separating them into India and Pakistan. But they were a good lot.
Anything said to you personally by Indians about British presence in India?
No. None of them seemed to object to it at all. We didn't find anyone, at least I didn't find anyone on the troops, who was saying, get the British out. You know, that. No, they were much more concerned about their own personal affairs and their own village and what was happening there. I don't know, I'm not saying that this is typical everywhere in India, but this was my experience. At Christmas 1945, our battery decided, no, our troop decided to give a present to the others. So we set up a truck, which we called the Holiday Inn? I think perhaps we did. Anyway, something like that, with a barrel of beer on it. And we went round to the other sites, offering drinks to them at Christmas. And, it was when we had moved down from the north into Coimbatore, that for some reason or other the officers' mess there had to be closed, and there was a small amount of money left over in the accounts, So we decided that we would buy a gramophone with it, a wind-up gramophone. And we looked for some records that go with it. And we found a few, but only a few records in English. I remember there was Webster Booth singing the flower song from Carmen, and Your Tiny Hand is Frozen. But and we also had Maxine Sullivan, that's right, singing Loch Lomond. And the Indians was one record that they loved in particular, and they would want us to play it over and over and over again, and that was Jingle Bells. They couldn't have enough of hearing it, Jingle Bells, on this old 78 record. What else? Well, we came. I'm sure there's some other things I was going to say, but they've gone. We were, of course, waiting to go home. Now, I was a teacher, and I was eligible for what was called Class B release. That was, I could be, because there's a shortage of teachers. And that reminded me that when I first joined up, Lieutenant Paradise, my very first commanding officer, when I found out as a teacher, said, you'll be all right for a job after the war. And of course he was right, because there was a great shortage of teachers. I could have got out early, but I would have had to lose a lot of my gratuity. This would have cost me quite a lot financially, and we were now saving up to buy a house after I was discharged.
Which gratuity was this?
Well, everybody, solely when they're dismissed, when they're discharged eventually, released, have a gratuity. And that depends on the length of your service and also on your rank, on which pay you were getting before. So I would have lost something on that. Oh, also, well, I've forgotten to mention, I was by now promoted to captain. This was acting unpaid. No, sorry, it was acting captain, but it was paid. So it meant that I got a captain's pay now, and also that influenced my gratuity. I got a bigger gratuity for it. But I could have gone out early if I had given up some of this. So I left it for a bit to see how it would go. But it didn't come. We didn't get this posting. And I was kept waiting for anything. Well, eventually I thought, well, I'm going to apply for a Class B release. And just as I was about to fill in the form, a message came round, look, you're due to go. So I didn't fill it in, and we did go. Yes, the promotions came because a lot of the officers had now been repatriated. And Len Rodley, whom I'd first known as a captain, had become a major, and he was now our colonel, Colonel Rodley. Charles Havel, who had been my troop commander, a captain, was now a major. And I, had been a troop leader, was now a troop commander, and I was made a captain. So we were waiting for this to go home. And eventually this came. Actually, we were delighted to see that on the note saying entitling us to leave was fit to fly by air. So I thought, good, we're going back, we're flying home. But we didn't. We went instead on the Orion, which was a ship actually taking troops from Australia to England. And we were told that, as we held them, there were three of us. There was Jim Teasdale and myself and Brian Payne. That's right. And I was put in charge of the party because I was promoted to captain first. And Brian Payne was very annoyed because he'd been commissioned before I was. Anyway, the three of us went, and we were told that captains were entitled to a cabin on the way back. But we were told that if we insisted on having cabins, we could, but it would be another 12 months before there were any available. If we wanted to go now, we would have to sleep in hammocks below deck, which we accepted. We'd rather get home than that. So we ended up on the Orion, and it was on the Orion that the various things were done to keep the troops occupied when we were there. There were all sorts of other ranks as well in this one. And one of the things they did was set up a brains trust. And I was asked to be on the panel. Now, I don't really know why, but there it was. I mean, there were others, I'm sure, who were much more suitable than me. One of the others was that I think should have been on it was Rupert Croft Cook, whom I knew of as a writer before. He'd written some travel books and books and other things. And he was with us. Actually, there was an orderly officer each day on the ship, and I don't know how they were chosen, probably at random. And one day the notice went up, orderly officer, Captain R. Cook, right, without an E. Well, who's that? Can that be? And Rupert Croft Cook said, well, it's not me, I'm not going. So that day there was no orderly officer. The next day, orderly officer posted, Captain R. Croft. No, that's not me. So that's 2 days they didn't have an orderly officer, and I don't know that it made any difference to the running of the ship. Anyway, I discovered afterwards the war that he was actually Leo Bruce, who wrote detective stories as well. Anyway, we had this brains trust, and I was on it. The only other member of the panel that I can remember anything of was a major who was a lawyer and was going back to take part in the Nuremberg trials. But all I know is that I'm not very good at speaking impromptu, talking on my feet. And we had no prior notice of questions. They just came from the floor. And I know that I did not distinguish myself. I don't think I made a fool of myself. I was not outstanding on that one. The others were much better. Anyway, we got back to England to a doctor at Liverpool, and when we got there, I think it was the Liverpool Echo, headlines in the paper. Hellship Orion arrives in Liverpool. Officers forced to sleep on deck. Officers' kit floating in water. Well, what had actually happened was that in the tropics, we were in hammocks below deck. It was so hot. We were delighted to be able to sleep on deck. And we used to take our bedding up and sleep on the deck. But in the morning, about 6 o'clock, the ship's crew would come round to swab the decks down. And we had to get up and move our bedding. And one or two didn't. They just rolled over and said, go to... And so their bedding did get wet. But you would hardly call it a hell ship. No, we were just delighted to be back in England. Then went down to Reading, to a discharge centre, got my civilian suit and the Trilby hat. And a first-class rail warrant to take me to Watford, where my wife was waiting. I think that was the last time that I ever rode in a first-class rail carriage. Never afford it after that. And that was it. Lieutenant Parrott had been quite right. I had no difficulty in getting a job as a teacher in England.
Whilst you were in India, did you ever come across any disturbances?
No, I'm afraid not. They've all gone on very well.
How do you feel now about having served in the Royal Artillery in the war?
I feel a bit of a fraud, really. I don't know anything that I did which actually helped the war forward. I did what I had to do, which wasn't very much. It was certainly an experience that I'm glad I've had. Now, I think one of the worst things that can happen for somebody is to be at school, go to college to learn to be a teacher, go back into school and spend the whole of their life doing that. I would never want to be a Mr. Chips. And I think that nearly 6 years in the army was a great help to me in learning to understand other people and how to get on with people of all sorts, different sorts, not just teachers.